The Athletic FC Podcast Network.
Hello. You'll hear the show in just a moment, but it's now 5:30 p.m. on Monday afternoon, and we've had an update from Newcastle United with some more information about Eddie Howe's illness. George, what's the latest?
Yes, so the club have now released a statement saying that Eddie Howe is recovering in hospital after being diagnosed with pneumonia. What that means for the time being is that Jason Tindall and Graham Jones, his assistants, will continue to lead the team against Palace and Aston Villa this week, and then the club will let us know in due course what will happen. So yeah, poor Eddie Howe. That's a very nasty condition to come down with. Eddie himself has been quoted saying, "A huge thank you to everyone connected with Newcastle United and the wider football community for your messages and warm wishes. They have meant a lot to me and my family. I also want to pay tribute to our incredible NHS and the hospital staff who have treated me. I'm immensely grateful for the specialist care I'm receiving, and after a period of recovery, I look forward to being back as soon as possible." So, yeah, obviously not nice to hear this, but good to know what it is that he's had, and also good to know that he's on the road to recovery, and also that he gets a bit of a rest. Poor man. And yeah, as we come on to talk about in this pod, he leaves the team and club temporarily in very safe hands. And yeah, the absolutely the most important thing at this point, the priority is for him to get better and to get back onto the touchline as soon as possible.
Yeah, definitely. We all send our best wishes to Eddie and his family. Thanks for that update, George. We shall return now to your scheduled podcast episode. Hello, I'm Taylor Payne. Welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your 5 wins from 6 against Man United podcast dedicated to Newcastle United from the Athletic FC. I've got George Corkin and Chris Waff with me today. I'm going to do that again. I've got George Corkin and Chris Waff with me today. How are we doing, Chris? Are we okay?
I'm going to refuse to answer in response to that.
Why have you called him that, Taylor?
I don't know. Just felt like a change, George.
Our athletic colleagues on other podcasts keep referring to me as if I'm Boris Johnson saying "whiff waff" or something like that. So,
yeah,
Chris Waff.
It sounds like somebody trying to take a shot at cricket and just completely missing the ball.
He's wafted it.
He's wafted at it, yeah, exactly.
I have to say, in terms of getting the wrong end of the stick, which obviously that was about, Chris and I went for a bite to eat on Saturday, which was very nice. We went to Flint Pizza in Heaton, which was
lovely.
Fantastic. And we went for a cocktail next door afterwards, Chris. What was it called?
Mother Mercy. No, is it Mother Mercy?
Mother Mercy. I think so, yeah. And it was like very nice. Lovely to see Chris. We had a nice chat and put the world to rights. And then as we were sitting there, these two women came up to us, which, trust me, doesn't happen very often to either Chris or myself, in bars. And I was pretty sure that one of the women, a big smile on her face, came up to us and said, "Best gin and vodka." That's quite a strange thing to say, isn't it, in a bar? But, like, you know, we'd all had a drink, Taylor. We'd all had a drink.
Yeah, we'd all had a drink.
So my response to that was, "Yes, it's delicious." Anyway, they sort of left looking slightly, I don't know, maybe disappointed or kind of confused.
Or terrified.
And what they'd actually said, Taylor, I am getting deaf in my old age, Chris will bear testament to this, is that they'd actually said, "Best tune podcast."
Wow.
And my response was, "Yes, it's delicious."
So that should be our new tagline. That should be-
And as they kind of walked through the door, thankfully, well, I don't know whether it's thankfully or not, it was one of those sort of realizations. I said, what did they say? Was it something? And it was like, "Oh, it's best team podcast." And so they did turn back and sort of looked again. And I did a kind of then really enthusiastic wave to sort of try and...
Which only makes things worse, doesn't it?
"Best gin and vodka, best tune podcast."
Wow, incredible.
I mean, it was nice gin, but I felt, yeah, it wasn't a great moment. So anyway, if that was you, thank you for coming over, and I am so sorry. I do not, in any circumstance, believe this podcast to be delicious.
I know a place that does go to your syringe, and so if you're interested, I'll give you the details after.
I actually do need to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Chris, how are you? Are you okay?
Yes, I'm very good, thank you.
Good.
The world is sunny from a Newcastle United perspective, except obviously one thing which we're going to talk about in a second. But yeah. Yes, to see Newcastle crush Manchester United was in very many ways fun. Absolutely hilarious. So, yeah.
It certainly was. Always fun. Well, as you said, Chris, first point of order, it's got to be to send our best wishes to Eddie Howe. And while it's clear the details of his illness are being kept private, it certainly sounded like an ordeal, and it was great to hear his condition has improved. I think everyone's feeling exactly the same, Chris, with this, aren't they?
Yeah, and I mean, we don't have absolute specifics on the exact situation. The suggestion last night seemed to be that he is improving and hopefully is getting better, but we don't know the full ins and outs. We just have to wish him all the very, very best. He has been very ill. You speak to any players or coaches and they basically said for Eddie Howe to miss one day is massive. He doesn't really miss one day of training, never mind to have been absent all week. And then obviously it was concerning on Saturday when the statement was released saying that Eddie Howe had gone into hospital overnight on Friday and then was going to be kept in for observations going into Sunday, so would miss the game. So yes, just wish him all the very, very best and really hope he makes a speedy recovery.
Yeah, echo all that, just to send lots and lots of love to him and get well soon. What an incredible man he is. What an incredible manager he's been for Newcastle. It does take me back to his first game in charge, if you remember.
That's right, yeah.
You know, there'd been the sort of high of him coming in. And then it becomes clear that he's going to miss his first game as Newcastle United manager because he's got COVID. And I just remember the way I felt that day was, oh man, this is like such a bad start. It's like you've got one chance to make your first impression,
get onto the pitch,
put the stuff you've been doing in training into practice. And then, you know, we hear that he's still in his hotel room, pacing and kind of fretting as, you know, he's in constant communication. And in the end, Newcastle drew 3-3 with Brentford that day. And it was like, it was a very different kind of performance from the Newcastle team, but it wasn't the result that they needed. Yeah. And I just remember that feeling of sort of dread afterwards, thinking, it's doomed this season.
Yeah.
Shows what I know. but like the biggest tribute that you can sort of pay Eddie Howe is that all this time later, he misses his next game in charge and it's like clockwork. You know, there's a plan in place,
yes.
There's a system, there's a way of doing things. All of these processes and systems that he's put into place over the last few years come into effect.
He clearly trusts those around him to put those into place, doesn't he?
Trust the excellent people around him, whether it's off the pitch or by the touchline, to do the job. And again, think about our own recent history of like angst and worrying. And it's like, oh, it's not, and he's stripped that all away. Really, that was the best tribute possible to what he has done at Newcastle. So, yeah, get well soon.
Definitely. Right then, just before we crack on with that Man United game, let's talk about Super Sunday. Sunday began well and things just got better and better. We've got to say congratulations to the lasses. 6-0 against Blackburn Rovers at Kingston Park. Shania Hales opened the scoring. Freya Gregory notched her first in black and white and Beth Lumsden made it 3-0 at half time. Emily Murphy added a fourth and two goals from substitute Isabella Sibley turned it into a rout. Becky Langley was frustrated by the result 2 weeks ago against London Lionesses in a game she said Newcastle United completely dominated. Newcastle are now out of the championship title race, and this result won't have eased Becky's frustration much, even if it's a very positive indicator for next season, George.
Yeah, it leaves them sixth in the table, which really doesn't tell the full story because they're only 4 points behind third. But it is, as we've said week in, week out, it's such a brutal division, and London are now 9 points ahead of Newcastle. And yeah, it can't happen this season. It's a good way to bounce back. That was sounded like a absolutely kind of ruthless performance. And yeah, Becky had those hopes and dreams of three promotions in a row that she talked about before the Sunderland match with us. It's not to be this season, but it's been a great learning season for them. First time at this level, and they will be stronger for it. A great performance, great victory.
Fantastic stuff. Right then, chaps, let's get on to the fun and games of yesterday. As we've already said, we've got to say testament to the gaffer and his staff in particular, who put in that excellent performance and got a great result. Chris, Jason Tindall, was his time to shine, wasn't it? I'm sure he took that very happily. I was worried, you know. I thought, don't get sent off in the first 5 minutes. Just don't go in there all guns blazing. He managed the situation great.
He did. Tindall's fascinating because, I mean, he describes himself as an extrovert, and also on the touchline, you see his antics and the histrionics, and usually he's the sort of attack dog, which is where, I suppose, the nicknames come from.
He's the balance, isn't he? The balance and the force.
Yeah. But when initially he was taking the press conference on Friday, when he suggested that Howe would hopefully be back for Sunday, once we found out that the Tyndall would take the press conference, I sort of messaged my editors and sort of said it's going to be Tyndall this morning. And people got quite excited because they suddenly think, oh, it's Jason Tyndall on the Twitter. He'll say something, you know, really, really controversial, or, you bite on something.
Yeah, provocative,
yeah. And he's actually the complete opposite in that situation. Part of that, I think, is because you might think of him as the alpha male, but Eddie Howe's very much the alpha male in terms of at Newcastle. He is the boss. Everyone knows he's the boss.
Yeah.
And obviously Tyndall's just stepping in for him. But also, he comes in the press conference room, he sits back from the microphone, you actually can't really hear some of his answers in the room, and he gives fairly anodyne answers, to be honest. Really, he doesn't say anything that other than talking about he can just be himself on the touchline. He doesn't bite on anything like that. But then watching him and observing him during the match, it was different in that, aside from I think it was the 9th minute when he had a bit of a go at the fourth official, there was none of the usual sort of arguments.
Yeah.
He was actually focused on his role. He still did all the stuff with set pieces, which is usually his role. He wasn't absolutely ever present. There was a couple of times he went and sat down and chatted to Stephen Purchase, another one of the first team coaches, and who was receiving information from Graham Jones, who was in co-charge, the other assistant head coach, with Tyndall. Jones, during the first half, sat in the press box. He does that usually in the first half of matches. It's almost like to see it from a slightly higher perspective to give the observational view. Then Jones came down during the second half, and there were a few interchanges. I think Jones actually got told off a couple of times by the fourth official for being in the technical area a bit too much. But it was different from Tyndall. He said it was a different experience for him, not having Howe there, not being the one who's sort of up and down and speaking to the bench and obviously speaking to the fourth official. But as we said, as George said earlier on, what was so impressive was not just that Newcastle won and won convincingly. I think the performance was largely an embodiment of everything that is the best that Eddie Howe has brought. You had players performing well, like Joe Linton and Jacob Murphy, who he has improved. Players who he has come in and his coaching staff, and they've dramatically improved them. But also the intensity, the fact that it was swift, the fact that Tyndall was on the touchline and he was trying to get Newcastle to play quicker. He was picking the ball up and throwing it to his players to get them back on the pitch. It was almost like when Howe in the Amazon Prime documentary basically said, if they want an effing quick game, we'll give them an effing quick game. It felt like that sort of thing against Manchester United again. And yeah, it was just a different, very different dynamic on the touchline, really.
And Chris spoke to Dan Byrne after the final whistle, and he was suitably pleased.
Yeah, buzzing. I think we spoke beforehand, we wanted to sort of put a performance in that the gaffer would be proud of, and I think we've done that today. I thought from the very first minute you could feel that we're on it. We sort of pressed them well and forced mistakes when they played out, and when they played longer, I thought we dealt with that well. So disappointed to concede. I thought we sort of limited them to not many opportunities, but yes, I've just heard it's like the first time we've done the double over Manu since 1931 or something, so it's been a while coming. I think another big milestone mentally for the club, knowing that we can sort of do that now.
You mentioned about doing it for the gaffer. I mean, how did the news filter through to the players? When did you find out about the severity, I suppose, that it was?
Yeah, no, I think we'd had a few sort of illnesses, and then the gaffer hadn't been in. I knew it must have been bad for the gaffer not to come in. He's never not in, especially 2 or 3 days. So, yeah, we don't know a lot about it, to be honest. Probably know as much as everyone else. I didn't know that he'd sort of been taken into hospital and stuff. But as I said, just from the lads, I just wanted to put in that performance and sort of wish him well. And hopefully he's back.
What was the preparation like with sort of Jason and Graham leading it? How different was it, or how similar was it?
No, it was very similar. I think that just shows the character of the squad and the staff that we've got, that we're very professional and went about it in exactly the same way. Nothing changed from us. Obviously the gaffer's big out there for sort of driving standards and pushing training, but I think we've got a good group. The leadership group can push that. The staff sort of weren't letting we rest. We're going properly, and we knew this is going to be a huge week for the season, so we're prepared well for it.
It's been a product of Howe's work over the last few years, George, hasn't it? People have a proper clear understanding of their roles and how to go about their work, and as we said earlier on, it's clearly the case that he trusted that team and that staff to get the result.
Yeah, it's a great word, that trust, because it infiltrates every single layer of the club and the team. It's like, if you're in the dressing room, you want to know what your own role is in the game that's about to happen. And you want to know that the lad sitting next to you knows what he's supposed to be doing. You want to have that trust in each other. You want to have the trust in the partnerships that there are in the pitch, whether it's centre-half, whether it's midfield, whether it's down a flank. Everyone knows what they're supposed to be doing and when. And it's the same, you know, it's the same within the weekly work of a club. If you trust people, if you respect people, it makes it so much easier. You know what to do. And of course, so much about training is about repetition, and it's about repeating good habits. And so, you know, like, obviously, when you have an emotional match where a game ebbs and flows, some of that stuff can go out of your head. But I think, like, you know, one of the great things about Howe, whether it's about the, you know, the semi-final in the League Cup against Arsenal, whether it's about the final itself, not stripping emotion out of performances, but channeling emotion,
yes,
trusting yourselves, trusting each other. And this was, you know, this really, without Howe being there, having that sort of repetition, having that understanding, yeah, very, very sort of powerful. I thought it was interesting. It was something that I actually asked Jason Tindall about afterwards, about how his role changed on the Saturday. And kind of, I think one of the interesting things he talked about was how, you know, he and Eddie know each other so well that it almost becomes a sort of, you know, it's not like they're one and the same person, but they are very much a managerial duo, and they kind of know what each other is going to do. Anyway, this is what he said. I thought it was interesting.
We've worked together for so long now. We've been together for 17 years. We know the expectations and the demands set upon ourselves individually and what we set upon the rest of the group. And it's then down to the players to take that information on board and go out and deliver a performance. And, you know, they certainly went out and did that today.
Yeah. He obviously, he missed his first game here. Your first game here that was kind of intrinsically involved throughout that whole day. Did he have any involvement at all in picking the team, naming the team, being part of that?
No, I think the team probably picked itself in recent performances, but, you know, where he was ill and he was unable to be in, he put his trust in myself and the work and the rest of the support staff to go out and, you know, sort of deliver the performance. He trusted that, you know, if decisions needed to be made and tweaks needed to be made, that would make the right choices and make the right decisions. And, you know, thankfully that happened today. And as I say, you know, I'm sure he'd be really, really proud of the players' performance.
It just shows though, George, doesn't it, that there's not just one man driving the standards. It's right across the full staff, the full squad. When you've got that many leaders out on the pitch as well, when you get a situation like this, it makes it a lot easier, doesn't it?
Yeah, and as Chris says, I mean, Tindall does have this larger-than-life character. He's very much an extrovert to Howe's introvert. But he's also a very serious football man. I mean, yeah. I think we forget that he's shit-hot at what he does. We know that about the role he plays in set pieces, for example. You don't get to work in the Premier League, certainly not at this level, by just being a bit of a kind of sidekick.
Yeah.
And, you know, he loves the limelight. But I think this showed a very different side of his character, just how focused he was. Yeah, he had the odd occasional word with the fourth official. But the interesting thing was how much of his time Tindall was actually on his own, sort of particularly in the first half, sort of orchestrating the whole thing. But yeah, he is an excellent coach in his own right. And so I think it's only right that whilst we pay tribute to Howe, it's also right that we pay tribute to the people who work with him and who help him drive the team forward.
Just on that, I mean, Howe actually refers to it as a partnership between him and Tindall, because it is basically that. They fans of other clubs maybe see Jason Tindall and say, why is this assistant head coach getting so much? Why is he there so often? But it basically, he is more than an assistant coach in that sense, an assistant traditional coach. He basically is almost on a level with Howe. Howe is the leader, and that's what Tindall kept saying. But the two of them worked together. Howe only took the job at Bournemouth initially by insisting that Tindall stayed there. And they talk about having a shared philosophy. And I know that Tindall makes a lot of decisions anyway, even without bothering Howe with them, because he knows that Howe has that trust with him. And it is almost like that mutual decision making. And then when George mentioned the others. Graham Jones has obviously stayed on and joined the backroom staff post-takeover when Eddie Howe arrived. And he plays an influential role as well. And so everyone who is there with merit. Howe is sometimes accused of being too loyal or only bringing in people he knows. But the reason he does that, the reason he keeps these people very close, is because he trusts them inherently. He knows that they know what he wants, what he expects, and that they are very, that they are elite coaches, because he will not accept anything less than that.
And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Well, hopefully, one man did love it. The War Flags tribute to Kevin Keegan was supposed to be against Liverpool, but a facile win over Man United, a very fitting result on the day, George.
Yeah.
It was great, wasn't it? I loved seeing it.
It was lovely. Yeah, the tribute itself, it was beautiful. It was over, you know, three of the stands. Beautiful sort of Keegan spelt out on the east stand, which just looked gorgeous, and then big tifos in the Gallagher, in the Leasers, lots of flags waving, and absolutely the right thing to do. It's something that War Flags have wanted to do for a long time. Obviously, in an ideal world, they'd have loved Kevin Keegan to be there to witness it.
Yeah, that's it, isn't
it? But yeah, and you know, one day I hope we do get the kind of chance to, you know, not say goodbye, but say thank you.
Yeah.
Because obviously he left, the last time he left was on, you know, such a sour note, when he stood up for his principles, wouldn't let Mike Ashley impose signings upon him, and kind of walked out. But, you know, he was the guy that dragged, along with Sir John Hall, dragged Newcastle into the modern era, into the Premier League, you know, saved the club from oblivion, which is what it was facing when he came back in as manager, having already once, you know, led us as a footballer, brilliant footballer. And, you know, then, yeah, took us into the Premier League and played that incredible, expansive football that will live with those of us who are lucky enough to witness it forever. And, you know, I said on social media that he was the man that made all this possible, and he was. You know, it's like, if you talk to Howe about his influences as a manager, he'll talk about Keegan's, you know, entertainers team in the mid-90s. But the point is, this version of Newcastle couldn't have existed if Keegan's version hadn't existed. Of course, why was it so special yesterday? Well, because it was always Man United, wasn't it? It was always Man United. From the moment Newcastle got promoted in 92-93, Keegan said, tell Sir Alex we're coming after him. And my God, we came after him. That story ended in disappointment. 95-96, you know, that brilliant Newcastle team that eventually tired and were overtaken by an absolutely fantastic, ruthless Man United team. We always forget how many games they won in the second half of that season. And that became the start of a one-way rivalry, really. It didn't really figure on their consciousness, but it certainly did on ours. And then, you know, it was the cup final. It kind of just always felt like it was them. And of course, it was them 2 years ago in the League Cup final, and it was them last season. They're still our end of level boss when we've finished above them for the first time in the Premier League era, and they still find a way of getting into Europe. Interjection, did that actually turn out to be a good result for Newcastle?
Yeah, possibly.
Didn't feel like it then. It's just always been Man United. And sorry, I'm kind of going on a bit, but like, you can't just dismiss doing the double over them for the first time in almost 100 years in the league, going to Old Trafford this season, winning for only the second time in the league since the early 70s. Yes, this is a dreadful, appalling, witless, vapid version of Man United. It's a fact that this is the worst Man United team of the Premier League era. But even so, it's a big psychological moment for Newcastle, and dodgy moment in the first half aside, they were just swatted away by Newcastle. And how beautiful is that?
It was brilliant. And as you mentioned, George, as you alluded to, it's easy to forget, isn't it, given that the football of the Keegan era, it's 94 years since we've beaten Man United twice in the league. On the day, really, there wasn't much anxiety about the result once the game started. They had a bit of the ball in the first half. But Newcastle, Chris, were dominant in terms of territory, weren't they? Almost camped out in the Man United box at times.
Yeah, well, it was interesting if you looked at the possession stats in the first half and at half-time, because Man United actually had quite a lot of the ball. But what Newcastle did was basically let Man United have the ball in their own half. And there was this desire to play out from the back that George, it will have infuriated him. He wasn't actually sat next to me at that stage of the match, but this I mean, it eventually obviously led to the fourth goals we'll come on to later, but a goalkeeper who isn't very good at playing it out from the back. They've obviously dropped Andre Onana for his calamitous mistakes recently, but Onana actually is quite good with the ball at his feet. And Newcastle, they pressed a lot more than they have done at points this season. It was similar to when they played against Spurs. It was basically man for man. And at large points of the first half, Fabian Scher and Nick Pope were the only Newcastle players in their own half because Scher was following Xerxes, but then Dan Byrne was going upfield to follow other players, and you know Garnacho was being pushed back, and so Newcastle's fullbacks were pushing on, and it was just basically all the action was happening in the sort of between Manchester United's half, between the halfway line and like Manchester United's box. That was where all of the action was happening. And yeah, Newcastle had seen that Man United want to play this way, but aren't actually very good at playing this that way. I mean, Ugarte has played at St. James's Park twice, and I think he's been Newcastle's best player twice. He was awful for PSG during that 4-1.
Yes.
And another 4-1 this time. He kept giving Newcastle the ball, and the first goal comes from him conceding possession, because he might be a good defensive midfielder in terms of breaking a play, but he isn't actually very good with the ball at his feet playing out from under pressure. And Newcastle, really the embodiment of Newcastle's performance was Sandro Tonali and the rest of the midfield, because they just overwhelmed Manchester United.
That pressure was the reason for that first goal, wasn't it? We won the ball back and it's played in by Trippier. And it's an absolute thing of beauty, isn't it, Chris? I mean, what a finish that is. The lovely little touch, control and ball over the top from Isak. And I mean, you're better at describing these things than I am, Chris. Come on, paint pictures with your words.
Oh, it's an absolutely sublime goal. And the thing, I can't quite work out whether Alexander Isak's first touch is deliberate, regardless of whether it is or not. The fact that he then caresses a sort of lofted ball over the top of Manchester United's back line. It's almost like when you sort of see people, you see players before a game sort of doing like volleys and headers to one another. It isn't like how you'd usually hit it, because it is almost caressed. It's very softly that he floats the ball perfectly into the flight path for Sandro Tonali, who's made the overlap and run on the right-hand side of the box, and then he volleys into the ground and across the goal in the left-hand corner. It was picture-perfect, really, as a goal. And I felt Newcastle had needed it for all of the sort of... I thought the final ball had been lacking up to that point. Isak had had a chance, which he'd headed wide. But beyond that, I thought that for all of the good positions Newcastle got into and for all of the sort of pressure they put onto Manchester United, they hadn't actually provided that bit of quality. But then, all round, that goal was just absolutely top-notch quality. They've won the ball back, which is exactly the game plan was. Trippier's ball into Isak.
Yeah.
Isak's second touch, and then Tonali's one touch. Absolutely sublime.
Do you know what my favourite thing about the goal was? The goal was beautiful. I loved it. But my favourite thing was when Tonali's celebrating and he smashes that ball off the cone, the spare ball that's sitting in touch, and he smashes it. And it ended up in level 7. That's how hard he hit that ball, and it flew. And I was just like, oh my word, that is brilliant. I love seeing stuff like that. Took it back to Isak in the cup final, did the same thing, didn't he?
The only disappointment with that is that it didn't hit somebody in the nuts, because that would have been a proper Matt Ritchie moment, wouldn't it? Matt Ritchie throwback. I would just like to point out that Chris, goal description waff, had to ask me whether that was actually a volley or not.
No, later on, because I forgot this was. Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm not gonna bother justifying that.
Bite. Why? Bite. Go on, bite.
It's what he wants, Chris. It's what he wants.
I'm not going to.
Ah, so disappointing.
But just on the, when I was speaking about the Newcastle being more physical in midfield, I do want to give a shout out to Carl Anker of our Talk of the Devils, the Athletics Manchester United podcast, who did refer to me as Chris Waff on their podcast, that he, before the game, I was chatting to him and sort of saying, like, are Man United as bad as they seem to be? And he basically said, Newcastle are the kryptonite for Man United in terms of they will just be more powerful, more athletic, and the midfield three will bully them. And that's exactly what it was. The difference between the sides was stark, but it was even more stark in midfield. It was actually embarrassing how much better Newcastle were in midfield.
It absolutely was. Garnacho making it 1-1 just before half-time wasn't exactly in the script, was it? Except it sort of was. They'd had some dangerous breaks. George, Nick Pope making a decent save as well from Xerxes at one point.
Yeah, I was a bit worried at that point. I mean, you know, which again, that's my old instincts kicking in. But I have also seen Newcastle absolutely batter Man United at St James's Park and then lose 1-0 in a game that nobody wants to be reminded about. So I've seen it before. And yeah, it, albeit Newcastle didn't have a load of clear-cut chances in terms of sort of shot saves, that sort of thing, they were clearly dominating. They had a lot of pressure, and it just felt like they should, you know, on the weight of the game, they should have been 2-0 up, 3-0 up even. And they weren't. And there were moments when Man United countered, and they did show some lovely moments. They have got some good players, right? They have got some good players. They're an awful team, but they do still have some individual quality. And yeah, for the equaliser, Ugarte kind of won back possession. It's Dalot that then moves forward. He fits Garnacho, and it was a great speedy, quick movement, and that took it to 1-1. And at that point, yeah, there was a sense of sort of frustration where I was, and annoyance that Newcastle had sort of let them get back in.
Yeah,
because they didn't. I mean, as I said, they'd had moments of threat, but they didn't deserve it.
And Chris, Jason Tindall wasn't happy with Newcastle's handling of Diogo Dalot, was he?
No, well, it was the entire left hand side, and Tino Livramento was magnificent going forward, but during the first half, they'd already been, before that, the goal, twice, he'd already been sort of caught high up the pitch, Newcastle down the left-hand side, and Dalot was the one who was really creating things for Manchester United, his ability to carry the ball and then lay it on, as he did for the goal. And twice it had happened, and the second time that it happened, which was for a ball that was eventually played across the box, was just behind Xerxes, so it didn't actually come to a chance, but Man United really should have made more of it. Tindall turns around to the bench and seemed to say, that's the second time. And then he turned around and was shouting, Tino, 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 for about 30 seconds. And basically you could see him saying, don't jump as high in that initial moment on Dalot, let Dalot have it deep. And he then said afterwards, Tindall, he basically said, we made tweaks to the press at half time. So this is, again, no input from Eddie Howe. Between the rest of the coaches, they slightly changed and tweaked it on the left-hand side, so that rather than it being Manchester United who were getting joy down that side, it was actually Newcastle who got the joy. And obviously, eventually, the second goal comes from Livramento advancing down that side. So again, in-game tweaks and very clever management from on the touchline.
Yes, that pesky equaliser only served as an opportunity for Newcastle to show off their game state prowess, George. That's a nice little callback, isn't it? Fragile Man United defence were clinically dismembered with two goals in no time at all after the break. We have to pay tribute, George, to Harvey Barnes. Anthony Gordon is back in that matchday squad, but he's making it very difficult for him to get back in the team, isn't he? He was brilliant.
Yeah, and I don't think you can overstate how important this is. If you go back to the start of the season, Harvey Barnes scored some goals, but then has found it difficult. And I think we've said this, and I don't think it's an unfair comment to sort of say that he felt like the last holdout in terms of players not really being transformed by Howe. Yes, you know what he's going to do when he's on the ball, but he seemed to be kind of struggling for confidence. He wasn't coming on and making a difference. Obviously, had Gordon in front of him in his preferred left wing position. And yeah, it felt like this, it just wasn't working. And again, let's go back to how we all felt when Anthony Gordon got suspended, got himself sent off.
Yes.
ahead of the cup final, and how helpless we all felt. And like, let's just give the trophy to Liverpool now. And again, Gordon hasn't been missed. Newcastle have found a way of winning without him, with Tino Livramento at left back and with Harvey Barnes at left wing. And he scores goals, and he's scoring goals, and he looks like a transformed player. You know, you want him to sort of take games by the scruff of the neck. He doesn't do that, and I'm not sure he can do that, but he is contributing. He's contributing off the ball more, which I think is very important. I think... You talk about some of the narrative around the team in the dressing room at the start of the season, when Anthony Gordon had been heavily linked with a move to Liverpool. There'd been negotiations with Liverpool. There was all this uncertainty around the team, but also that he was kind of undroppable. It's so valuable to every single member of the team, but to Gordon in particular, like knowing that he now has a fight to get back into the team.
Yeah.
That's really important. That's the kind of level of competition you want across the squad. And yeah, well played, and congratulations to Harvey Barnes, because he has absolutely taken his opportunity, and yeah, fair play to him.
He really has, and I wrote about Tino Livramento over the course of the last week, and basically how he's still long-term seen as Newcastle's successor to Kieran Trippier at right-back, but he's actually thriving at left back. He did last season when he played there, but this year he's actually added that attacking mindset over the course of the last few weeks. And every game now he's using his left foot more, and obviously the second goal,
lovely feet
comes
for
from
that. Goal. Lovely feet.
Yeah, he absolutely sells Dalot, pretends he's gonna go on his right, cuts back onto his left, and then plays a lovely ball across the box, which Jacob Murphy I thought he was gonna shoot, but he didn't. He did the right thing, which was to put the ball back across for Harvey Barnes to finish. But I think that Livramento is really benefiting from having Barnes in front of him. Now, it may be the same if he had Gordon, but the fact that when he's been on the right-hand side, when you have Jacob Murphy in front of him, Livramento, he then have a right-sided a right-footed, right-sided player, and I think that that's limited the space for Livramento. I think he wants to dribble, he wants to get to the byline, but when you've got someone hugging the touchline in front of you, I think he's just sometimes almost second-guessed himself and looked a bit ponderous on the ball at times. He doesn't know necessarily what he should be doing. Whereas on the left, because Barnes has given the freedom to come in, I mean, during the first half in particular, quite often Barnes was appearing almost as like a number 10 position, yes, running inside. And then because he cuts in, and obviously that's where the third goal comes from as well, Barnes nicking the ball and cutting inside, Livramento has that space and he has the pace and dribbling ability, which is exactly what Newcastle saw in him as a youngster. It was actually the defensive side that had more question marks and they thought he was going to need a lot more work on, but his defensive side has arguably been his best elements at Newcastle. That's what he's really, really excelled at so far. But to see him flourishing and the confidence has really grown between to have built that partnership in such a short space of time, I think is very, very impressive. And yeah, it's really great to see, because the concern going into the final was Newcastle have lost their entire left-hand side, and yet arguably two of Newcastle's most consistent performers since that West Ham game, the one pre-final, have been Tino Livramento and Harvey Barnes.
We've spoken about people taking to their roles as well. Livramento, one of those. On Sunday, there was only one Bruno, wasn't there? He rounded off the scoring before mouthing the words, "I am the Bruno," to the crowd. Lovely moment. He was overjoyed, wasn't he? It was great.
Yeah, and what a dreadful mistake.
Horrible, wasn't it?
Newcastle took advantage of. Yeah, I mean, Amorim having made that change in goal. Ugh, dear me. The keeper kicks the ball out. Jolinton jumps up, nods it back to Bruno and finishes. And yeah, this is the team that Newcastle now are, that are taking advantage of other teams' mistakes, which is just kind of great to see. I mean, it is, yeah.
It speaks volumes to me, George, that they were that high and still pressing at 3-1.
Yeah.
Just on that, though, I was just going to interject Mr. Point afterwards, but I'll do it now. Tonali, about 3 or 4 minutes beforehand, had pushed Bruno Fernandes up against the, it was a Man United goal kick, but like Tyndall then on the touchline was
right
sort
in front
of gesturing.
Of the Gallagher.
Right in front of the Gallagher, and Tyndall started gesturing as if to do that again. And then Tonali sprinted and followed the goalkeeper and sprinted across the back line, and then Newcastle pushed high, and it was clear at that point. Tyndall said afterwards, he said, "We want to keep scoring goals." There was at no point that we thought 3-1, you know, we'd just settle, even though we've got games this week. This team is set up, and what they want to do is they want to take advantage in those moments. And that's exactly, it was basically like they sensed blood there, and that's what they went in to make sure that they did finish the game off.
This is the thing, and it does come back to my very strong annoyance with this way of playing. It was just logical. It was the best way for Newcastle to keep playing. I mean, yes, they scented blood, but it was like Man United were squirting their blood all over their own butt. What a strange image I've just created there. But I'm going to stick with it. It's like, if they're going to carry on playing out like this and they're not equipped to do it, and they wait, just keep doing it. And it is like a form of self-harm, that way of playing. I honestly don't understand it. But Newcastle took advantage brilliantly. And yeah, it was just a way to keep playing. And
it also helps when you've got a 6'7", 6'6" centre-back who is winning everything in the year. So if you do play it long, he's going to gobble it up anyway, isn't he? So I can understand why it kind of puts teams on the back foot a little bit and they're not sure about kicking it long. But like you say, it was just self-harm, wasn't it? They walked straight into
But I also, and Jolinton reacted very smartly. I want to pay a bit of a tribute to Jolinton. I mean, not, as Chris said earlier, it was the physicality in midfield that played a huge role in winning that game for Newcastle. He has somehow, again, managed to avoid another booking, which means I think that if he avoids a yellow card against Palace, that threat of an automatic too much ban goes. So fair play to him, because he's gone four games without a booking. But like, one of the images of the match for me yesterday was, you know, Jolinton's number's gone up, he's coming off, and at that point he's gesticulating to Ogati saying, "I'll see you in the tunnel, son." And he does it once, he does it twice, he keeps doing it. He's being dragged off the pitch by Bruno and he's saying, "I'll see you in the tunnel." And it's like this total and utter reinvention of Jolinton is now complete. I mean, it's like, that's the most old school image you could possibly see. "I'll be waiting for you in the tunnel afterwards." I mean, just
and a Brazilian saying it to a Uruguayan, I imagine that would be. That would be tasty as well.
There could be sparks there. There could definitely be sparks there. We've got to say thanks to Lizzie in Wide Open as well, who messaged about Jolinton, essentially mirroring George's comments there about how brilliant he's been. Forest were beaten by Everton, and Chelsea were held at home by Ipswich. We really are in the driving seat now for Champions League football, George, only 1 point behind Forest in third.
Yeah, it's just been a brilliant run, hasn't it, around the final. And all of the fears or concerns that you might have, that the sort of energy gets sucked out of the team. They've done this sort of historic achievement, and really, do they have anything else to give? Well, it's been the opposite. They managed to go into the final with some momentum behind them, and then they've just really carried it on. And yeah, some good results for Newcastle over the weekend. But they're the team in form now. And yeah, they're back up to fourth. They're on 56 points. Forest have 57, but Newcastle have a game in hand. So that means that, you know, if they beat Palace on Wednesday, which I don't think is a done deal, no, by the way, if they do that, they then go up into third. And with those five places now, top five places now counting towards the Champions League, they're absolutely in a really, really good, strong position.
A draw puts them third, actually, on goal difference.
Yes, right. It does, yeah. Yeah.
But I was just going to make the point. I asked Dan Byrne about this after the match as well. I sort of said, were there ever any fears from you personally in that moment after the cup final that things could go the other way, that it would be that Newcastle just almost rest on the laurels? They've been the first side to win a domestic trophy for 70 years.
After the Lord Mayor's show.
Exactly. And he said, look, I'll be honest, you never quite know in that moment, but he always believed, because of the standards that are driven by Eddie Howe and his staff, that that just wouldn't be the case. And I knew that Howe let them enjoy that moment, but then it was, there is so much more to achieve here. And because the players are desperate to get back into the Champions League, that the mentality within this group is so strong. So yeah, it was an interesting conversation with Dan Byrne. As a few journalists speaking to him, we flitted from talking about Eddie Howe being absent and how it was obviously beating Man United, and he made a point about how we as Newcastle fans, he said, we basically hate Man United, we love getting one over on them. He then talked about this and the other Champions League race, and he also talked about someone crashing into his truck and him pushing a car, having to push a car from a roundabout near Blythe because he was involved.
Hang on, his truck. He drives a truck.
Yeah, he described it as his truck because
it's like a big Dodge Ram or something like that.
Well, I don't know, because the response was, oh, you know what happened to your truck? And you're, oh, basically, it's only got like a tiny scratch on the wee side that you couldn't do anything to that truck. So it must be like, yeah, it must be like
Dan Burns.
He's not
still working for Asda doing deliveries, is he?
He's a big country music fan.
I wasn't sure what you were going to say there. Sorry.
so he's so it might be that kind of truck. It might, but I don't know.
He also made a remark about because he said, so I got out and, you know, we're pushing this guy. And I think it was an electric car. So it was actually heavier than you thought. And he said, yeah, you know, it was. I was grateful for all those people who, rather than helping, took photos.
What a man, though. It captures him, though, isn't it? It's like, it's, yeah, brilliant. What a man. Is there anything this man can't
absolutely.
And won't do?
Right then, the games are coming thick and fast. We've got two to preview after the break. Let's have a little break and we'll be back in a moment.
Can I go for a very quick wee, please?
Come on, you Maggies.
So as we said, Newcastle will go third in the Premier League if they can either draw or beat Crystal Palace at home on Wednesday night. And they'll be just 4 points behind second place Arsenal. It won't be easy though, George, will it? Palace gave Man City a proper fright at the weekend.
Yeah, they'll be 4 points behind if they win. Yeah, and I think if you look at that result, 5-2 to Man City, you sort of think that that Palace were hammered. But actually, they went into a two-goal lead and let it slide.
Right.
And that result, so they've just conceded 5 goals away from home. That leaves them on 17 goals conceded away in the league this season, which is still the second fewest after Arsenal. And so if you take that 5-0 away, they would be the tightest team away from home. So I think we have to look at Crystal Palace like that. Their form since Glasner has come in has been astonishing. They're 12th on the table, but that's not a fair reflection of their form. And they're also in the FA Cup semi-final. So they
play some very decent football as well.
And they play some very good football. So I think if you look at that last result, look at the table, you might have a very different sort of opinion about the team that Newcastle are going to be playing. And of course, historically, in terms of this season, it's the kind of team that Newcastle have struggled against. So let's see. I mean, I think they'll be a much tougher test than Man United were, which kind of says everything.
Yeah.
But they've got some good players, and take that result away, they've got some really decent players and are in Yeah, really decent form.
That recent record against Palace is okay, Chris, isn't it? They haven't been able to win in the last two meetings, but they were both at Selhurst Park. Three wins and a draw in the last four at St James's.
Yeah, I do think that at least before a few weeks ago, you would have said that Palace are exactly the sort of team who you would fear coming to St James's because of the way that they play. I mean, Newcastle, though, since basically the final, really, have been in this mode of... The Man United game was the most complete performance. Byrne referred to that as, I think that's the first time we put 245 minutes together outside the final, where it's like all game, you'd say they played well. But I think they've been very efficient and they've looked like a side who know what the end goal is, and that's to just keep winning matches and make sure they're finishing the Champions League. So I think that because of the momentum Newcastle have, they have a very good chance this game. But Palace are dangerous, and it's about how Newcastle recover. Three games in 6 days is a big test for Newcastle. They haven't had to do that much this season because they haven't been in Europe. They did very, very well over that Christmas period when they went to Man United, Spurs and Arsenal and won all three in that short period of time. But to do it, Alexander Isak, we know, has had a few sort of issues in terms of he's been managing a groin problem. They have a few of their sort of physical ailments in players. Can they name the same starting lineup again? Because they've named them in five successive matches in all competitions. Can they do that? Or are there going to need to be changes and tweaks? The fact that Anthony Gordon's back on the bench is a positive in that sense, because there is a little bit greater depth there now.
Is there any updates on those injuries, Chris? Joe Willock is struggling with a concussion problem. Kieran Trippier seemed to take a bit of a knock.
Yeah, I don't know the exact ins and outs in terms of when Willock's concussion protocol period is meant to end. I think he has to go through tests before he can potentially come back, but he was definitely going to miss the Man United game, so I think there's a potential that he could return. Trippier, Tindall said afterwards, he's all right, he's fine. The same with Alexander Isak, he was taken off on a precaution measure. So I think it'll just be about physically how the players can recover and whether they go for the same 11 again, try to keep that momentum going, or whether they shuffle now and then make changes at Villa. It'll be interesting to see which direction they do go down. But it does feel like there are options there because Gordon's back. They're obviously Miley and Longstaff. Newcastle do have a few options if they do want to change things a little bit or actually need to physically.
So hopefully everyone, bar the long-term absentees, will be available for what looks like a bit of a tougher test come the weekend. Saturday tea time trip to Champions League quarter-finalists Aston Villa, albeit they might have exited that competition by the time we play them, George. It's going to be a tough test, that one, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think we have to hope that there's the same sort of thing that happened to Liverpool pre-cup final, having sort of had that big emotional disappointment of losing to PSG. Something similar happens to Aston Villa. It's a huge task they have facing them now, 3-1 down to PSG, who do look like the favourites for the Champions League at the minute. But yeah, we know that they're a good team with a very good manager, and it won't be an easy one.
Be nice if they got a couple of goals and took it to penalties, extra time and penalties. Just push them all the way, just like Liverpool did. That'd be great fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we, like Newcastle experienced, had a bit of a taste of this last season about, you know, having those kind of huge highs, huge lows in the Champions League. Newcastle have definitely benefited. You know, this is why I asked the question earlier. It felt very disappointing and deflating at the very, very end of last season to have that place in Europe sort of taken away from them. You know, the big idea at Newcastle is that they're in Europe every season. You want to, having done it once, you want to experience it again. You want to become hardened to it. The players want to be there, want to experience it. But it can also be kind of very, very draining. And I think the fact that Newcastle, albeit they're not having a free week this week because they've got the Palace game as well, I think having that clearer run has helped them in some important moments. It's definitely helped them in terms of the size of the squad or the depth of the squad, not having to call upon it quite so much. You know, being able to name the same team that Howe and Jason Tindall have now done, that's definitely helped them, as has the lack of injuries. But see what happens. I think that's I think it'll be all eyes on Villa PSG on Tuesday night, and then see where that leaves them ahead of the game on Saturday.
Chris, Villa are having a bit of a resurgence, aren't they, in their own pursuit of Champions League football. They've beaten the likes of Brentford, Brighton and Forest, and they've put some good results together this year, and they play some decent football as well.
Yeah, and I mean, there's obviously been sort of parallels drawn between Villa and Newcastle, partly because of the sort of how quickly their trajectory has been in a similar way to Newcastle with a new manager, and also because Unai Emery, we know, was very close to becoming Newcastle manager before Eddie Howe actually took on the role. So they are a good side. Weirdly, The first time Newcastle went to Villa Park in the Emery era, they were turned over massively, and I thought that season was really the one time they were really outplayed against a big side other than when they played Arsenal at home. That was in the Champions League qualification season. But since then, Howe's had a bit of a number on Unai Emery. Now, whether Howe's back in the dugout and actually leading the team going into that match and making the decisions, we're unsure. But Newcastle have really managed to get him, particularly behind Villa's high line that they like to play. And it'll be interesting to see if Emery adapts or whether Newcastle still have one over on Villa. It does feel like a real opportunity for Newcastle, particularly despite Newcastle playing 24 hours after Villa. The amount that Villa are going to have to put into that PSG tie if they want to stay in the Champions League is going to be huge. So I do think this is an opportunity for Newcastle, because if they were to go there and lose, then that brings sort of Villa really back into the sort of picture and maybe muddies the sort of Newcastle's progress towards the Champions League qualification places, which now they have to be the favourites of everyone because they have that game in hand. They're already in fourth place and they have momentum behind them. So in that sense, you do look at it and think that Newcastle, from this point, Ben also said this, he said it would be a disappointment if we don't finish top five because we've got ourselves into this position now.
So we had a message off Joe at Pidgeos on Blue Sky. I was having a think in the shower this morning, chaps. That's where I do most of my thinking. I'm not sure where this is going. Flag idea for Villa Park. Okay, that's not too bad. Has to be an image of Ant and Dec with the cup above their heads and the words Messiahs. That's brilliant.
I like that.
Yeah. Yes, like this that. Obviously like refers that. To, for those who don't know, this will refer to, there's been a rivalry which we developed between Newcastle and Villa fans largely since 2009 when Newcastle were relegated at Villa Park on the final day of the season and there were Sob on the Tyne banners and our Ant and Dec, yeah. Messiahs and the like banners in that regard.
Who's your next Messiah, yeah, Ant or Dec, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah, brilliant. Yes, I think if we can knock that together, that would be great. Any other business, chaps, before we finish off?
Well, Jamal Lascelles, his contract is not up this summer, the club captain. That was something we wrote about last week. So when I wrote that, I also made the point that this doesn't change the fact Newcastle are still targeting at least one centre-back this summer. They want a right-sided centre-half, but they've obviously, Fabian Schär signed his new deal contract through till next summer. The same with Jamal Lascelles. But this was something the club haven't officially confirmed publicly, but it is the case that Lascelles, who was given a one-year extension
last year... Is this a WAF exclusive, is it? Is that what this is?
I suppose it is, yeah. I suppose if you want to refer to it as that. But during his period with this ACL injury, he has had an extension for another year, so his contract actually runs through till 2026. And I think given everything he's been through, obviously he hasn't played at all this season, he's had complications coming back from the ACL problem, but he's been huge behind the scenes. He was obviously, Kieran Trippier and Bruno Guimaraes brought him up to lift the Carabao Cup with,
yes,
those are the two captains, the sort of on-field captains at Wembley, and then in the display on the town were. So I think that feels like an important move in terms of what's going on behind the scenes. And I know some people have questioned that, so why would you give him that? But I think that he has been so massive in terms of the culture, as Eddie Howe referred to it, behind the scenes, that is a positive move. And it also just clears things up a little bit going into the summer when people think Jamal Lascelles is just going to be out of contract. He isn't actually out of contract. He does actually have another year.
Fabulous stuff. George, you wanted to say something as well.
Yes, I would like to say hello to Les Stewart, who came up to me yesterday before the match and we had a nice chat. Said some very nice things about the pod, talking about listening to the post Cup Final one and listening to it in the car, which is what he does, and lots of people being in tears. We've had that sort of story from a lot of people, which we will have to revisit at some point, I'm sure, as the season comes to an end. But yeah, hi Les. And yeah, he also kind of reached out on social media and said, keep up the good work, to which I can only reply, yes, it's delicious. You needed to be listening to the start of the pod to understand that reference.
Brilliant.
But yeah, I think that's going to become my catchphrase. Yes.
Yeah, I have to say thank you to the couple of chaps who came up to me last night at my gig down on the Quayside, who had been at the game and said very similar things. I didn't catch their names, unfortunately, but I do really appreciate you coming over and saying hello and telling us how much you enjoy listening to the pod. It's always lovely to hear that, isn't it? The address, if you want to get in touch and say anything or any meat-based sponsorship opportunities for the pod, very much welcomed by Chris Watt. podonthetyne@theathletic.com. Let us know. Right then, chaps, that's just about it. Thank you very much for your time, George.
You're very welcome. Let's do this again sometime, shall we?
Yes, let's. It's been very, very, very good fun. I don't know.
We've beaten Man United twice in the league this season.
We need to do a joint podcast with the other lot, with the Man United lot, just we so we can do. We can rub it in.
Just just mispronounced their names as well all the way through.
I'm not.
It was good. It was good that moment, wasn't it? At the end, the Gallagher singing, "You've seen the real United now."
You've seen United now. F off home. Brilliant stuff. Thanks for your time, Chris.
You're very, very welcome. As things stand, we do not know. So the pre-match press conference for Palace will be Tuesday, which is tomorrow to record. We are assuming it's going to be Jason Tindall. We don't know yet at this stage. Obviously, our thoughts are with Eddie Howe, and fingers crossed that he will be back on the touchline very, very soon. Well, mainly back to full health, but also on the touchline very, very soon. So yeah, just finish where we started, really.
I want Jason Tindall on the touchline in a gold Adidas tracksuit with a backwards baseball cap on. That's what I want on Wednesday night. That's what I'm hoping for. With the biggest shit-eating grin you've ever seen in your life. That's what I want. Anyway.
And a warm hoodie.
And a warm hoodie. Oh, a lovely warm hoodie. That's what you need this time of year. It gets a bit chilly on a night time, doesn't it? Thank you very much, chaps. Thank you to all of you out there listening as well. Please come back and listen again. From everybody at Pod of the Time, we'll speak to you very soon. Bye-bye.
The Athletic FC Podcast Network.